Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Everyone, particularly those who are charged with passing and writing our laws, should have to live under the same laws as everyone else in the state. The governor, frankly, thinks it's ridiculous that somebody would be driving 140 miles per hour. It doesn't matter who they are.
It's not immunity. The legislature can still be held liable for whatever they do. It just says you can't detain them when they're in session for the purposes of stopping them from voting.
I've gone to court successfully and had that kind of nonsensical libertarian junk thrown out. It is absolutely deceptive to refer this to a 75% increase. It is a 3.46% increase.
I think that the evidence is significant, and it is clear that the management at this utility has not been appropriate to provide an assurance of public safety and reliable public services.
And with us to talk about the chances of eliminating legislative immunity, along with challenges to proposed ballot measures, are former legislative leader Chad Campbell, vice president of Strategies 360, and John Gabriel, editor of Ricochet.com and a contributor to the Arizona Republic. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chad, did you ever consider invoking legislative immunity when you were in the legislature?
No. Never crossed my mind. I was never driving 140 miles per hour. Either to or away from the legislature, although I think there were some days when I wanted to drive 140 miles per hour away from the legislature. But no, I did not. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion down there while I was down there to try to figure out how to repeal that. There were bills introduced almost every session. They never got any traction. But hopefully, I think with these latest developments, it sounds like there's some bipartisan unity coming together around this issue.
John, does the Paul Mosley situation lend itself to serious action like this, or does it just give people a chance to, once again, from a microscopic sense, say, wow, legislative immunity, what does this really mean?
Yeah, I think I'm very glad that they're changing it. And you've just had a few lawmakers who are out there abusing the system. You know, this was written into the Arizona Constitution back when you were concerned that Sheriff Wyatt Earp or something would drag you away so you couldn't make a vote. That this isn't the case here if you have a traffic ticket. Not that I've ever gotten any. But yeah, there it's a civil procedure, and it falls under the Arizona Constitution's concerns about breach of peace. That's one of the things that you can be arrested for. And it's just kind of foolish that certain people have abused the system for something this petty.
Is there a lack of understanding among legislators about what this legislative immunity actually entails? We heard in the montage there, Senator John Kavanaugh talking about how it doesn't preclude you from being cited, just not during the session. I mean, if you're speeding, if you're driving 100 plus miles an hour and you claim legislative immunity, doesn't mean you're not going to get a ticket. Maybe just means you're not going to get a ticket right then.
Yeah, I think it's I think in a lot of legislators' minds, it's a do you know who I am syndrome type of thing that takes over. And I've heard some comments over the past week or so that nothing really had ever happened before this Mosley incident, so it really hadn't been kind of in the forefront. But that's not true. We had some other legislators in the past, including when I was down there, who tried to invoke legislative immunity for really much more serious issues than just speeding. And so I do think there's a lack of understanding. And again, I think there's the old, you know, old school of thought that absolute power leads to corruption, whatever that saying is. I think that's probably part of this, too.
Well, let me ask you about that, because as you said, there have been other invocations of legislative immunity in domestic violence type situations. Why is excessive speeding maybe going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, as opposed to something, Chad, as you referenced, to more serious, you know, beating people up on the side of the road, for one?
I can't answer that. I think maybe two things. I think that in this day and age, these videos go viral now. That's helpful. Wasn't the case 4 or 5 or 6, 7 years ago. And I also think the flippant manner in which Mosley dealt with this issue and kind of laughed about it and talked about how he did this repeatedly probably showed the severity of the problem.
Yeah, I agree completely. It was kind of a perfect storm on social media, and I saw people who have never lived in Arizona sharing this saying, can you believe this person? So it really shined a light on it, and I think it's something that many people at the Capitol have wanted to address for a while, And I'm glad they're finally moving on this. Before, once again, it's used for something more serious, like a horrible domestic violence situation we've seen in the past.
Now, John, as you mentioned, though, it's in the Arizona Constitution. So this would take voter approval to actually remove it and take care of it. So is there enough? Is this something that, because it wouldn't happen anytime immediately. So is this something that Paul Mosley's name would have to be invoked again? Does he become a pioneer in a sense, leading to legislative immunity? And that's what he becomes known for.
I don't know. I doubt his name is very popular right now around certain quarters, but I think it could definitely motivate people to clarify the language. And that's the thing. It says breach of the peace, which does sound pretty vague. And I think some police departments were just like, let's just not mess with it because we don't know all the legal implications of this. Can we detain this person? Can we even cite this person? So it's good they're clarifying it. They're clarifying with rules now. But I think the Constitution will need to be changed just to have a little more clarity put into that. What exactly does that mean, breach of peace?
And I would say, you know, if you're giving Paul Mosley credit for this, it'd be like giving Scott Pruitt credit for cleaning up the EPA or something like that, basically.
Or Ernesto Miranda with, you know, it's Miranda rights. Thank
exactly,
you.
Right. So, and I also, I mean, to the point of the voter support of changing the Constitution, I would assume this would pass with about a 97% approval rating amongst the voters of Arizona, excuse me.
And Chad, quickly on this as well. I don't think any of us is an expert on that particular district that Mosley is in, but he does have a challenger in the GOP primary. Do you think this is the kind of thing that reflects negatively, or does that depend on the district?
I mean, it's the primary. Probably John knows better than me. Primary side of the Republicans, but I would think this affects him negatively no matter what, regardless of the base you're trying to engage.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's just an abuse of power. And I think people, if a Democrat was doing it, Democrats would look at him askance, just like Republicans would in this situation. It's not like he's this critical member who's passing all this legislation for them.
Do you think that there will still be momentum in January to do this? I mean, January politically, especially, is a long time away from now. And assuming that there's not another situation where somebody tries to invoke legislative immunity, will people still be talking about this in January long enough to get legislators to refer this to the ballot?
I think it's a real slam dunk for politicians. It's popular. And look at me, I'm rooting out corruption. And it's something that regardless of party, regardless of which office you're running for or trying to win up successes in, it makes you look good that I'm standing against corruption. And it doesn't really adversely affect the vast majority of politicians other than the person who would want to abuse it.
Yep. And if he loses that primary to the earlier question, I think it will add even more momentum to wanting to fix this problem in January of next year.
So, Chad, as we know, a number of potential ballot measures could be going to Arizona voters in November, one of which is the Invest in Ed, and there's a major dispute over that. There's a lawsuit over it. And what's interesting about it, at least for some of us, is that the way the numbers are being parsed. So is this increase on people who make more than $250,000 actually just a small percentage increase, or is it a 78% increase, this sort of thing? Obviously, this is up to a judge to decide. But what do you make of the arguments? It's before we turn on the microphones, of course, John commented, no shock, there are lawsuits on these, of course. But does this sort of tack make any sense to you, regardless of what side you're on?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense from a political angle. I don't know about the policy itself. I'm not enough of an expert on how the tax laws work and the codification of these tax laws. I will be honest. I've heard from both sides, people that support and people that oppose the initiative itself, various arguments that could support or undermine the lawsuit. So I'm as confused as everybody right now. And I think that's why attorneys get paid a lot of money and it's going to be up to a judge. They're going to a courtroom and they're going to fight this out. You know, the bigger question, I think, at the end of the day is regardless if this ballot measure passes or gets on the ballot and passes or doesn't pass, at the end of the day, we still need more money for education. And from a native Arizonan who's been trying to fight for funding for our schools for over a decade now, we still have to have a solution on top of this solution for more money next year. And I hope somehow everybody puts aside their differences after this lawsuit and after this ballot measure fight and comes together and finalizes that last piece of that puzzle to get our schools our funding.
Yeah, and I think we see this again and again with these initiatives. Just they always end up in court, and the people who oppose the aims of that initiative are going to find some technicality that this is egregious, this is shocking, I can't believe this would head anywhere near the ballot. And the people supporting the measure will argue in favor of it. The details of this case is something where you read it, you go, read it again, read it a third time, and then say, like Chad said, boy, I'm not a lawyer. I don't really understand what the issue is.
Well, there's usually either a legal challenge or there's a confusion confusing ballot measure that sounds sort of like the one on there, so voters have no idea what to do.
Right.
Well, and the conventional wisdom is always that if a voter doesn't really understand what the implications are, they just vote no to keep the status quo. I'm wondering if for supporters of, in this case, Invest in Ed, is there a danger that not only are you fighting people who don't support the policy at all, but who might not really understand what it's doing and might just be inclined then to vote against it?
Right. I think that is a serious danger. And just talking to people on the right side of the fence, especially my dad, his default is, oh, no, that's change. That's scary. You know, typical kind of old school Arizonan there. And people, if they don't quite understand it, they're probably going to vote no, just like, is somebody trying to trick me here with the phrasing and what's going on? So the more simple, clean, to the point that legislation can be written, the better, I think, for its chances of passage.
Chad, is that something that supporters are going to have to try to overcome, assuming that this makes the ballot?
Definitely. And I think that, this environment created by the lawsuit is going to help confuse the situation for voters. I think that's probably part of the PR strategy from the opposition side. Rule of thumb in ballot measures is the simpler and the easier the language is, the more likely it is to pass. So you're going to see a lot of money spent and a lot of arguments from both sides trying to educate the voters on why this is the right solution. I think this court case is just the campaign beginning, regardless of how the court decides. This is really the campaign beginning in earnest, well ahead of actually debating with the voters through the media.
Well, it's interesting to see, too, because this is not a state that typically likes tax increases, but the few times we've seen it, it has been directed toward education.
Yeah. I mean, look, Arizonans support higher taxes for education funding. Every poll I've seen for the past couple of years has shown that. The devil's in the details, though. We saw that in 2012, I guess it was, with the proposition that was put on the ballot, it actually failed. And it was one that was going to fund education. I think the problem with that ballot measure, which a lot of us pointed out that were on the pro side of it, but were concerned about it, was they tried to fund too much beyond education with that. The scope got too big.
Right.
So the good thing about this ballot measure from the advocate side is it is focused just on education. That's a good thing. If you're on the opposition side, though, you're probably looking at it and saying, there's a lot of complicated language in here, and we're going to try to take advantage of that.
Yeah, John, final thoughts on the Invest in Ed specifically on that?
Yeah, I agree completely. If it's something that people can grasp, like quarter cent sales tax or something, it's like, okay, I get that. When you get into these more complex formulas and no, we're only going to raise taxes on these people in these 13 cases, then it just gets so complicated. People aren't sure what's going on, and they don't want to feel snookered a couple of years down the road.
That's John Gabriel. Also here is Chad Campbell with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap here on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests this week, Chad Campbell, Vice President of Strategies 360, and John Gabriel, editor of Ricochet.com. So, Chad, another ballot measure that's being challenged. No big surprise, because Tom Steyer, the out-of-town billionaire, has been blamed for trying to change Arizona's energy policy. There's a major challenge going on. APS is involved in this, challenging the signatures. They turned in many, many, many more thousand signatures than they needed. What are your thoughts about this one? Again, not a surprise it's being challenged, but what about the TAC?
This one got messy really quick, and it was a lot of money on both sides, obviously, which is something that's not always the case for ballot measures in Arizona. Sometimes one side's well-funded, the other side isn't. In this case, you have Steyer funding this. And APS isn't run by a bunch of paupers either. Let's not kid ourselves. So you had two, multi-billion dollar entities running campaigns against each other. And we're seeing the result of that. I mean, this is a really ugly fight. And unfortunately for the voters, regardless of what ends up happening with this challenge, I hope at some point we actually have a discussion about energy policy and put aside all of the political grandstanding and rhetoric, because we really do need to talk about sound energy policy in this state.
Yeah, I agree. The lawsuit itself isn't a surprise, but there are some troubling allegations that a lot of these signatures are invalid. It'll be interesting to see in court how much truth there is to that and things, but there were issues about felons going out and gathering signatures, which isn't allowed, and how this extreme number of signatures were falsified or found to be from people not registered in Arizona. I think, too, this is intensified by having this you know, kind of classic this California billionaire liberal trying to telling us how to live our lives. So if it stays in the ballot, I think the campaign will get far uglier. This could be one of the ugliest things heading into November.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, I agree 100% with John. I mean, again, that goes back to my point, though. Where the money comes from should be irrelevant, quite honestly. So much money comes in the state from out-of-state donors. I mean, most of Joe Arpaio's campaigns were funded by out-of-state donors. So that's hypocritical from anybody, not you, John, but anybody on the right saying
hypocrisy
that.
Hypocrisy in
politics?
Exactly. No.
Shocking. And that's why I hope the debate gets back to energy policy. But again, I mean, there's a lot of money involved on both sides. So to John's point, this is going to get really ugly. It already is. It's just going to get uglier, unfortunately.
And I think Tom Steyer, too, he just he can be caricatured, especially in this state, as this cartoonish villain from San Francisco trying to tell us how to live. And I think that's how it can get personal very quickly.
As Steve mentioned, the campaign for the ballot turned in a couple hundred thousand more signatures than they needed. How big of a deal would it be if after all of that, the initiative did not have enough actual valid signatures to make the ballot? That's a pretty high invalidity rate.
Right. It would have to be absolutely extreme. And some people critiquing this are saying as many as 70% of the signatures are invalid. So it'll be interesting to find out when they delve into the details, okay, how did you come about this? Is this just more PR that you're trying to push? Or are these really invalid signatures? It would be a huge fail, and I think Mr. Steyer would have a lot of complaints with whoever is collecting these signatures if he had spent this much money and got such poor results. So.
And Chad, there's been some controversy about how many of the signatures actually need to be counted.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the critics are saying we want them all counted. The county recorder is saying, yeah, there's no way
there's no human possible
way we can do that.
Yeah.
Like, how do you think that's going to be handled going forward, and could there be even more challenges?
I don't know how it will be handled going forward. I mean, that's a tough question. I don't see how you could physically count every signature. I don't think the resources are there. I just don't know how that could happen. I also think part of the problem is all of the changes that have been made to how you collect signatures and what's allowable, what's not, over the past few years, mainly by the GOP legislature, has made it very hard for a effort, be it grassroots-driven or be it well-funded, to get something on the ballot through the initiative process. And that was, I think, part of the plan from the GOP-led legislature. But, you know, if this does fail to get on the ballot, though, it is unprecedented. And I think you have to really look and see what would have been valid prior to these changes that was made by the legislature and see if that had a significant impact and that was the impediment from keeping this on the ballot. And if that's not the case and it would have failed under the old standards, then there was a much bigger problem going on with the campaign, I think, at that point.
And moving on, though, John, you've told us you're a former Republican. It's up to you to defend Representative Paul Gosar now.
He's doing wonderfully.
Apparently last winter, there's evidence now to suggest that he was one of those people that Governor Ducey was not happy with, sort of lobbying for John McCain's seat, as we found out more about Senator McCain's health. Of course, he still remains in office at this point. There's really not that much to say specifically about Paul Gosar, but this is another one that doesn't seem to reflect well on him.
No, not at all. It's just, you know, take it out of politics or partisanship. It's tacky. You know, somebody gets admitted to the hospital the next day. Hey, by the way, can I have this person's job? It's pretty ugly, low character. And it's something I was wondering who else Governor Ducey was talking about when he said a little while after he was admitted to the hospital, anybody who's been asking about the position has been invalidated. If I ended up needing to appoint someone. I'm sure that there were plenty of Republicans who were directly and not so directly saying, oh, by the way, I would do great in that role. So it is a pretty ugly thing to do. I don't think Gosar would be at the top of the list if he hadn't engaged in this behavior, but just by pushing this, he pretty much invalidated himself.
And Chad, Gosar's people have said that, well, you know, we need to have a contingency plan. We need to be ready to go. So what's wrong with him reaching out in this way?
I mean, again, it's tacky. That's the best way to describe it. It's disrespectful. Putting aside politics, it's just really, really bad kind of sinking behavior on a human level. Putting aside politicians, which I know sometimes don't equal humans. But I just, when I heard this news, it was very disgusting to me, and I'll just leave it at that, I guess.
Is there a sense that Representative Gosar or his people were the only ones contacting the governor? I mean, it seems kind of hard to believe that if there were to be an open Senate seat, that other people wouldn't at least be talking to people about the possibility of doing getting.
Yeah,
that.
I'm pretty confident that there were several people asking about this, but it's one of those things you want to try to position yourself to be placed in the U.S. Senate if you want it that bad without looking like you want it at all. So it's one of these tricky things, and it would be better for Gosar and anyone else just to keep their mouths shut. So it's just ugly. It's kind of like, you know, you're visiting an ailing friend and you're checking around his house. Oh, I like that boat that he has. You know, it's just kind of an ugly, low form of behavior.
And don't forget, I mean, Kelly Ward, a couple of years back, she was very public about her desire and want for that seat. So, I mean, again, it's just been a very sickening thing for me to watch. This is from a Democrat, but it's just not what I would expect us to be acting like when we're talking about Senator John McCain. It's below Arizona.
And, John, finally, it seems like Chad mentions Kelly Ward. Based on what Kelly Ward's husband is saying about Joe Arpaio, it appears sarcastically maybe the Ward family not a big fan of people who are of an advanced age.
Yeah, exactly. It's just very low behavior. It's like something out of The Prince by Machiavelli, you know, just looking at this, but they don't do it with any kind of flair or sophistication like he did. Everybody's scrambling for positions. And if you're going to try to do this, and, you know, obviously this happens in politics, politicians want power, but you need to do it in a way that's sensitive. And for someone like McCain, who's pretty much a state institution, just like Goldwater, who he ended up replacing, ultimately, you know, you have to be deft and you have to be respectful to these people based on what they've given, and just set your own ambitions aside, at least publicly.
That's John Gabriel, editor of Ricochet.com. Also joining us, Chad Campbell, vice president of strategies, 360. Guys, thanks for joining us on the newscast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.